طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. An exception to the denial of broadcasting the Palestinian narrative in the United States is Democracy Now!, hosted by Amy Goodman on Free Speech TV. A few days ago, the news program featured Palestinian attorney Diana Boutu and Israeli journalist Gideon Levy in a segment that I would like to rebroadcast this morning, as an illustration of the kind of reporting that should be available to us throughout the United States and is not.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, the United Nations Security Council is preparing to hold an emergency meeting to discuss the recent visit by Israel's new National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Jerusalem. His visit was condemned across the Middle East. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry called his visit an unprecedented provocation. The militant group Hamas warned Ben-Gvir's actions could lead to more conflict. Jordan has summoned Israel's ambassador to protest the visit, with Jordan's foreign ministry decrying it as scandalous and an unacceptable violation of international law. Al-Aqsa Mosque is one of the holiest sites in Islam. It's also one of the holiest sites in Judaism. Temple Mount was the site of a Jewish temple destroyed by the Romans 2,000 years ago. On Wednesday, Palestine's ambassador to the United Nations, Riyad Mansour, condemned Itamar Ben-Gvir's visit.
The attack is not only against our holy sites in Al-Aqsa Mosque and in the Haram al-Sharif. There are, because of this environment of extremism that this Israeli extreme government, the extremist in the history of Israel, is providing, is leading to additional aggression against our Christian sites, Christian graveyards. You've seen by now that there are crosses over, you know, graveyards being trampled upon and attacked by extreme settlers. This is a toxic environment. The international community has to speak with one voice in rejecting this extremism, in rejecting those terrorists and those elements of fascists in the Israeli government.
Itamar Ben-Gvir's visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque came just days after he was sworn in as part of Benjamin Netanyahu's new far-right government, which includes ultra-nationalist and ultra-Orthodox parties that are calling openly for the annexation of the West Bank. Netanyahu's selection of Itamar Ben-Gvir as his national security minister has sparked widespread condemnation. In 2007, Ben-Gvir was convicted of incitement to racism and supporting a terrorist organization. Ben-Gvir lives in an illegal settlement in the occupied West Bank. In 2021, he relocated his parliamentary office to the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Jerusalem, where settlers have attempted to violently evict Palestinian residents from their homes. For years, Ben-Gvir hung a picture in his home of Baruch Goldstein, an Israeli-American who killed 29 Palestinians at a mosque in Hebron in 1994. The Jerusalem Post's editor-in-chief described Ben-Gvir as, quote, the modern Israeli version of an American white supremacist and a European fascist, unquote. Ben-Gavir will now be responsible for border police in the occupied West Bank at a time when violence and the killing of Palestinians has been surging. To talk more about Itamar Ben-Gavir's visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Israel's new far-right government, considered the most far-right government in Israel's history, we're joined by two guests. In Tel Aviv, Gideon Levy is with us, an award-winning Israeli journalist and author, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, member of its editorial board. He's also the author of the book, The Punishment of Gaza. And in Ramallah, we're joined by Diana Bhutu. She is a Palestinian lawyer and former advisor to the negotiating team of the Palestine Liberation Organization, also a fellow at Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN. Her latest piece is an op-ed in the New York Times headlined as Israelis have put Benjamin Netanyahu back in power. Palestinians will surely pay the price. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Diana Bhutu, let's begin with you. Let's start with this latest action, considered an incitement by so many, both Palestinians and Israelis, not to mention the rest of the Middle East. Talk about who Itamar Ben-Gavir is. I mean, he wasn't just charged with incitement of racism against Arabs. He was convicted of it and supporting a terrorist organization.
Yes, Itamar Ben-Gvir he's a disciple. He's a follower of Rabbi Meir Kahane, who is a man who believed that Palestinians should be ethnically cleansed from their homeland. And Itamar Ben-Gvir has espoused the exact same views as Meir Kahane and continues to espouse these same views. He's talked very openly about his support for Baruch Goldstein. And his latest visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound is not just a visit. It's an attempt to show that there will forever be Israeli sovereignty on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and he's trying to incite violence. Not only is he trying to incite violence, he has long believed that the Al-Aqsa Mosque should disappear, and in its place, the Temple Mount be recreated. So his policies have always been that of inciting to violence, inciting to hatred, and although he was only convicted once, he has been indicted more than 50 times. The fact that he is allowed to be a minister in this government just shows how much it is that the international community is allowing fascism to reign and that they're effectively doing nothing. All that we have heard since this visit and since he's become minister is that the world supports the status quo, but it is that status quo that has led to people like Itamar Ben-Gvir being able to become minister and their actions being normalized. I fear that what he intends to do is to create more and more violence as a pretext to once and for all, as he put it, showing Palestinians who the masters of the house are. Those are his words, not mine.
Gideon Levy, could you also respond to Ben-Gavir's appointment as National Security Minister, and in particular, his appointment to this post?
Benjamin Netanyahu had to create a government. He's leading the biggest party. And he decided this time to go with the most extreme right-wingers. The problem is not this. The question is why those right-wingers are so popular in Israel. Mm-hmm. And here we face a reality which is well-known for a long time. The Israeli society is a very right-wing, nationalistic, and part of it, racist society. We have to face this. That's the main problem, not if Ben-Gvir is a minister or is not. The problem is, who are we facing when we speak about Israel? And in many ways, I see also a positive side to the results of the last elections by tearing all the masks. Now we see reality. Now it's not the umbrella of the Zionist left who speaks so nicely and does almost the same like the right wingers. Now we face the extreme racism in its most pure expression. Those people don't deny the racism. Those people say very clearly that the Jewish supremacy means that only Jews have rights in this land. And I hope that both some parts of Israeli society and above all the international community will finally draw the conclusions.
So, Gideon Levy, that's exactly right, that these far-right parties have received this kind of support, almost 11% in this election, but that's much higher than in the past. So could you explain why you think these far-right, hardline extremist parties are more popular now in Israel than they've been in the past?
It's almost inevitable. If you continue with the occupation, supported by the Zionist left, not only supported, led by the Zionist left, and if this reality of an apartheid state continues, it calls for extremism. It calls for telling the truth. It calls for tearing the mask and saying, we aim to be an apartheid state. The occupation is not temporary, the occupation is here to stay. And if it is here to stay, it means we are an apartheid state, and we are even not ashamed of it. After 56 years of occupation, you can't expect anything but this radical movement, while the Zionist left never tried to separate itself from the occupation, never tried seriously to put an end to it. So if there is no other force in the Israeli power, let's go for the extreme. This makes a lot of sense.
Deanna, could you also talk about that, the shift in the Israeli polity further to the right, and the role indeed the left has played? You wrote a recent piece headlined, Israel's so-called left has aided the far right's rise.
Yes, Gideon is exactly right. Look, there's been a so-called left inside Israel for quite some time. But this so-called left is, I say so-called because that's exactly what it is, so-called. They self-proclaim as left-wing, but this is a left-wing that has never stood up against the occupation. It's a left-wing that has supported the various attacks on the Gaza Strip. It's a left-wing that has supported the siege and blockade on the Gaza Strip. It's a left-wing that has supported the enactment of racist legislation, even in the past couple of years. And so when you're an Israeli voter who sees that the options are between this so-called left wing, which has supported the exact same things as the right wing has, then of course it's natural that they're going to vote for this fascist right. The big problem has been that we've never seen that Israelis have paid a price for their electoral choices. It's always been that Palestinians pay the price. And with this new government, it's going to be Palestinians once again, but even more than in the past. Unlike previous Israeli governments where there were other issues that they may have been focused on, this current government, this new government, is myopically and only focused on making life miserable for Palestinians. They don't have any other political platform other than to try to ethnically cleanse Palestinians. This is why we've seen since the beginning of this year that Israel has killed at least one Palestinian per day. And this is why we're seeing the plans to completely ethnically cleanse the Palestinian town of Musafir Yatta. It's because this government has put in its crosshairs Palestinians, and given that there's nobody in the international community that's stopping them, it's going to continue full steam ahead.
So let me ask you about Musafir Yatta, near Hebron in the occupied West Bank, the southern part. Israel's military has begun demolishing homes, water supplies, olive orchards. This week, Israeli armored vehicles accompanied demolition crews as they razed homes and farms in two villages. Last year, the Israeli High Court of Justice approving the home demolitions, which will uproot more than 1,000 people, leading to the U.S. Congress member, who happens to be Palestinian-American, Rashida Tlaib, tweeting, not even 1 week in 2023, new far-right apartheid government is moving to ethnically cleanse entire communities, which would displace more than 1,000 Palestinian residents, including 500 children, all with American backing, bulldozers, and bullets. talk about the U.S. support at this point for Israel. You have President Biden congratulating Netanyahu on his return to power, saying he looks forward to working with an old friend for decades, adding the United States will continue to support the two-state solution and to oppose policies that endanger its viability or contradict our mutual interests and values. Can you talk about what you feel, and I'd also like to Gideon's response to this, the U.S. should be doing now?
Look, the U.S. is way behind in the times, and if they still think that there's something left of a two-state solution, then it's only in their dreams that they're seeing it, because we certainly don't see it on the ground. Instead, what we have seen is that Israel has been allowed to do whatever it wants when it comes to killing Palestinians, when it comes to stealing Palestinian land, when it comes to ethnic cleansing, when it comes to crossing the red lines that are enshrined in international law. Israel's allowed to get away with it, and not only get away with it, but continues to receive support and financial support from the United States as well. This isn't just a question of statements, but they're also getting financial support from the United States. And what, as we look around the world and we ask ourselves, we're now in the year 2023, and they're still talking about a two-state solution that died more than two decades ago, and yet they've done absolutely nothing on the ground to make sure that two-state solution comes to fruition. Instead, all that they have done is to facilitate Israel's process of slowly ethnically cleansing Palestinians. One of the new members of this new government is a man named Smotrich, who came out just last year in 2021 and said that the only reason that Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, like me, are still allowed to exist is because the job wasn't finished in 1948, thereby basically telling us that our time here is short. What the U.S. has instead done is, instead of giving them a red light and scaling back and decolonizing and pushing for Israel to end its occupation, end its apartheid, it's pretty much served as a mask for Israel to continue to do whatever it wants to do. And this is why we're in this situation now. It's, we've seen that the world is doing nothing. We see that the Israelis, as a result, don't have to pay a price. And so, once again, it's going to be Palestinians that pay the price for Israel's electoral choices.
And Gideon Levy, if you can respond, also talk about what you're writing in Haaretz, a very well-respected Israeli newspaper on whose board you serve, and the response of the Israeli population, for example, to these demolitions.
Let's face reality. The United States is supporting the apartheid system, is very interested in continuing the occupation, and has no interest in human rights of the Palestinians. There's no other way to describe the American position throughout decades. Because would it be different? Would the United States seriously mean to put an end to the occupation? The occupation could have come to its end years ago, if not decades ago. So it's all about a hollow lip service that the United States is paying from time to time, all kind of hollow condemnations. By the end of the day, Israel, this apartheid state, is the closest ally of the United States. The money of the taxpayers of the United States go to Israel more than to any other country in the world. And this means that the United States is in favor of an apartheid state. Nothing else but this. As about your second question, the question about the Israeli reaction to what's going on in Misafer Yatta can be asked only, and Amy, I highly appreciate you, but can be asked only in the United States, not in Israel. Because in Israel, nobody cares and nobody heard about Misafer Yatta. Misafer Yatta is well known maybe to the readership of Haaretz, not all of it, maybe to a small devoted left camp, which is still active, but most of the Israelis not only couldn't care less, they never heard about it, and if they will hear about it, they will just yawn in your face, because finally they all buy the official propaganda, namely Israel is doing it against terror, Israel has to protect itself, and all those old slogans of lies and lies and lies.
And Gideon, could you outline what you expect the policies that this new government will initiate, from substantive changes to the judiciary, as well as restrictions on civil liberties within Israel itself, and, of course, what we said in our introduction, the steps towards the annexation of the West Bank?
As we talk now, the Supreme Court of Israel is dealing with some of the first actions, and the Supreme Court will try to stop them, but the Supreme Court by itself will be a subject of attacks by this new government, who is going to limit the legal system very much and very quickly. It's really admirable to see how fast they act, while the Zionist left had 1.5 years being in power and did nothing. They are not yet 1 week in power, and they are already running with their initiatives. Now, about annexation, I can tell you, but that's my obviously private view, I really hope they will annex the at least part of the West Bank, if not all of the West Bank. The West Bank was annexed 55 years ago. The West Bank is practically annexed to Israel. Israelis live in the West Bank and behave in the West Bank as if it's part of Israel, and it is part of Israel. Now, once Israel will declare it officially and legally, then it will be really a question, because then the apartheid state is declared. You understand that if Israel annexates the West Bank without giving full civil rights and national rights to the Palestinians, which nobody in this government or in any other government means to give, once this is happening, Israel declares itself an apartheid state. And then I would like to see how Washington and the EU and some others will react to an official declaration of apartheid. Will they treat it like the first apartheid state, namely South Africa? Or will they continue to hug Israel as a darling of the West, even though it's a declared apartheid state? So let's challenge the world.
Deanna, could you respond to the points that Gideon has made? And also, you've written a great deal in your recent articles, both about settler violence against Palestinians and Israeli security forces' complicity in that violence. If you could elaborate on that and respond to what Gideon said about apartheid.
Look, it's already an apartheid state, and I don't need for Israel to declare it to be an apartheid state. They already know it's an apartheid state. My fear is always, what is it that's going to happen to people on the ground? And whether Israel annexes or whether they don't annex, the result for Palestinians is the same, that Israel's continuing this process of land theft. It's kicking people off their land. It's turning Palestinians into people who are homeless, and it's killing them as well. This has long been its process, long been its system. Now, it's not just the Israeli state that does it. It's not just the army, but it's also Israeli settlers. We've already seen that in all of these years, with all of these attacks that have been conducted by Israeli settlers against Palestinians, that rarely, if ever, is an Israeli settler ever prosecuted for their crimes. They're rarely even charged for their crimes, much less see the full conviction. And this is because Israel has turned a blind eye towards violence that it perpetrates against Palestinians. But again, I don't expect anything differently from the Israeli state, nor do I expect anything differently from Israeli settlers. That is their raison d'etre. That is their reason for being. What I would have expected is that somehow the world community would have stood up and would have done something differently and begin to hold Israel accountable for its actions. It would have held the Israeli state, its soldiers, and so on. And instead, we don't see it. For example, just this past year, a Palestinian American journalist, Shireen Abu Akleh, who was also a friend, was murdered. by Israeli forces. Her death was probably the most investigated death that I've ever seen in all of my years of living here in Palestine. From everything from outlets from CNN to AP to the New York Times to NGOs and so on. And yet to this current day, we still don't see that anybody has been held to account, even though we know that it was an Israeli soldier who shot and killed her. And so this is what it means to be living as a Palestinian, is that you're always living in this space where your life means absolutely nothing, and that your life can be extinguished at any moment, whether that happens at the hands of an Israeli soldier, whether it happens at the hands of an Israeli settler, or whether your land and your homes are demolished by the Israeli government. That's what it means to be living as a Palestinian.
That was Palestinian attorney Diana Boutu and Israeli journalist Gideon Levy speaking on the news broadcast Democracy Now!, hosted by Amy Goodman. A second source that highlights the Palestinian voice is the online news service MondoWeiss, which offers a podcast that elevates the Palestinian narrative with outstanding news and analysis. This morning I would like to run a broadcast that features Josh Rubner, a Palestinian rights activist and adjunct professor at Georgetown University.
Welcome to the MondoWeiss Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Reed. At MondoWeiss, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. Last month, the U.S. held its midterm elections. A red wave never materialized, as many predicted, but Republicans did take control of the House of Representatives. Our U.S. correspondent, Michael Aria, caught up with author and Georgetown University adjunct professor Josh Rubner to talk about how Israel factored into the races and what we should expect from the new Congress on Palestine. Rubner is the author of Israel, Democracy or Apartheid State, and Shattered Hopes, Obama's Failure to Broker Israeli-Palestinian Peace. He is an adjunct professor at Georgetown University.
So, Josh, thanks for joining us. I wanted to start maybe by talking about the Israel lobby's impact on these midterms. What did you see that stood out to you in terms of their spending during these elections, and what were your big takeaways?
Well, I think it's important to note why we saw this huge shift in strategy this year by the Israel lobby engaging more in electoral politics and funding those campaigns. So I want to back up a step first and talk about the growing support we're seeing for Palestinian rights in Congress. So the congressional session that's ending in December this year has seen the most by far of any Congress that we've seen up till now in terms of pro-Palestinian and Palestinian rights initiatives, whether we're talking about Representative McCollum's bill to protect Palestinian children under Israeli military occupation, whether we're talking about AOC introducing a groundbreaking resolution to cut off weapons to Israel, whether we're talking about Representative Andre Carson introducing a bill to get some accountability for Israel's killing of Shireen Abu Akleh. And we can go on and on and on and talk about all of the different initiatives we've seen. This is what is making the Israel lobby fearful, this growing solidarity that we're seeing amongst largely the progressive wing in Congress for Palestinian rights. And so they decided on a very clear strategy to try to stop that momentum from building further, which was by inserting themselves into the Democratic primary process and funding it massively. It's important to note that between AIPAC's PAC and its super PAC, along with some other pro-Israel lobby organizations, they spent somewhere to the tune of $60 to $70 million when all is counted, in terms of trying to defeat candidates who were progressive and who were standing for Palestinian rights. So it's a very reactive mode, and it was a very effective strategy that was implemented by the Israel lobby, because we saw how, in many cases in the primary, this intervention made the difference in terms of electing a corporate Democrat who is more friendly to Israeli apartheid and defeating progressive Democrats. But that being said, I don't want to overstate the significance of what the Israel lobby was able to achieve with this massive injection of money into the midterms, okay? Because still, we're going to see the informal Palestine Rights Caucus in Congress grow next year, I think. And I think we'll see more diversity in terms of the numbers of different members of Congress who are willing to lead initiatives to support Palestine.
And connected to that, I mean, you already kind of just referenced it, but I have seen a lot of commentary about, you know, the squad potentially expanding. And usually when people say that, they're referring to domestic progressive policies, stuff like the Green New Deal or Medicare for All. Do you think the squad seemingly expanding will have any impact on support for Palestinian rights? You just said you thought it could potentially expand. How do you foresee we frequently see the Palestine as a blind spot with many progressives. Do you have any, I know it's early, but how do you see that shaking out with this new crop of Congress people coming in?
I think it's a little too early to tell and to make prognostications about this. You know, even though I believe that the Israel lobby's injection of the $60 to $70 million worth of money into the primaries helped to defeat some candidates, but won't necessarily stop the momentum. We can't be sure because this money could have a huge chilling impact. I think, though, the base of the Democratic Party, and especially the progressive base, will in general have to be more and more responsive as well to the base of the Democratic Party, which is becoming more and more firmly in support of Palestinian rights. So, you know, with this recent Israeli election of the most fascist government ever in Israel's history, you will see more policy clashes between the United States and Israel. And there will be more opportunities, I think, for not only progressives, but liberal members of Congress as well to insert themselves into this conversation and to really press the United States on this issue, because, you know, I think what we're going to see in many respects is a return to the dynamics that we saw during the Obama years with the very fraught relations between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu, which were, you know, very, very personalized in the policy debate. It was de-emphasized the policy differences between them. But I think, you know, you're going to see this really come to a head, especially in the next 2 years, with the Biden administration repeatedly clashing with the Netanyahu government, and especially its more even more right-wing fascist ministers that we're seeing put in place. And I think that will afford many, many opportunities for members of Congress to take increasingly bold stands in support of Palestine.
You're talking about, you know, Democratic voters coming around on the issue of Palestine in recent years, and even some lawmakers. I wanted to maybe turn to the situation in Florida's 10th district, which I'm sure you paid attention to. Maxwell Frost, who's fairly progressive when it comes to domestic stuff. A lot of articles about him, as he's the first member of Generation Z to join the House. He had courted the support, something we've covered at the site quite a bit, actually, is he courted the support of some local Palestinian groups in Florida and then seemingly abandoned his political promises to them. I'm just wondering your thoughts on that whole situation. What stood out to you, and what do you think? Do you think there's lessons from that situation to take away?
Well, as I understand it, he did more than just court Palestine rights organizations in his district, but he actually relied quite heavily upon them for the contacts, for the introductions, for the people power that he needed to really launch his campaign against a very crowded primary. So I think that he owed a great debt to those people who helped him get to where he is, which makes his throwing of the cause of Palestine under the bus even that much more problematic, I think. So, you know, that is a lesson, I think, to everyone, that, you know, it's not enough to get verbal promises from candidates. You know, we have to ensure that whatever promises are made, and I'm not saying that this is the case at all. In this case, I really don't know the details, but we really have to make sure that, you know, we get written promises from candidates if they want the support of people who believe in Palestinian rights, and that, you know, off the record conversations are not going to be adequate, especially because we know what's coming. We know what's coming in terms of the massive funding that's going to be put into any race where a candidate does take firm positions. But we've also seen how candidates for office can really capitalize in terms of their support for Palestinian rights, in terms of their own fundraising efforts. You know, it's no longer the third rail of domestic politics, and certainly not of democratic politics, to be out and forceful and strong on the issue of Palestine. So, you know, I just think that the main lesson here is not to rely on the good word and the goodwill of candidates, but really to get them to commit in writing to what they claim to represent, and to hold them to account. You know, that being said, whatever Maxwell Frost has said and done on the campaign trail, he's going to be a newly elected member of Congress starting in January. And, you know, he needs to be pressured and held accountable, just like any other member of Congress, you know, regardless of his very problematic history of this on the campaign trail.
You referenced this a little already, but, you know, this recently announced investigation to the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, it was recently reported that the Justice Department has launched its own independent investigation after, you know, we've seen pressure for months and months from activists, of course, her family, and ultimately Democratic lawmakers. Israel, of course, has already come out and said they refuse to cooperate with this investigation in any capacity. Can you talk a little about the activism around this issue and how Congress was pressured to, you know, finally get the FBI to take action?
Well, first and foremost, Shireen Abu Akleh's family deserves the credit for the activism that led to the opening of this FBI investigation. They have been absolutely fierce and relentless and determined to get accountability and justice for Israel's killing of Shireen ever since day one. And, you know, they came to Washington, D.C. over the summer. As probably most of your listeners know, they had a meeting with Secretary of State Tony Blinken. They had a press conference on Capitol Hill at which seven members of Congress spoke in solidarity with the family. And so they really deserve a lot of the credit for raising the stakes, raising the political pressure that was necessary to get this investigation started. Of course, they were supported in this effort by just about every single Palestine rights advocacy organization in the country that really put a lot of efforts into ensuring that an investigation would happen. And we saw that there were more than 80 Democratic members of Congress and even one Republican member of Congress who called for justice and accountability. The one Republican was Senator Mitt Romney. And, you know, I contrast this with other cases in which American citizens have been grievously injured or killed by Israel in the past. And, you know, the most close parallel I can think of is Israel's killing of Rachel Corrie during the Second Intifada, where her parents, Cindy and Craig, and other members of her family spent the better part of 2 years in Washington, D.C., you know, pounding the pavement, walking the halls of Congress, you know, trying to get anyone to listen to them and join their calls for accountability. And there was a congressional resolution to that effect that there should be a U.S. investigation into her killing. And I can't remember offhand the exact total number of members of Congress. But the fact is that despite their advocacy, which was, you know, equally as fierce and determined as the Abu Akleh family's advocacy has been, they never were successful in terms of getting the United States to open up a probe and an investigation into Rachel's killing. So, you know, in that sense, the opening of the FBI investigation into Shireen's killing is really unprecedented. It is the first time that I'm aware of in U.S. history where a U.S. citizen who has been injured or killed by Israel will receive at least an FBI investigation. And let's talk about why that's important for a second. It's not important as an end in and of itself, although it is a very important milestone, but it's even more important in terms of what it could lead to. So why does an FBI investigation take place? It takes place because the FBI has reason to believe that a crime may have been committed. This is what they're investigating. And in fact, we saw in the press accounts of the opening of the FBI investigation that indeed this is a criminal investigation. So what does this mean? If the FBI goes to Israel and conducts interviews and conducts whatever access they can get to the bullet and to other evidence and finds that there is a criminal act that has taken place, there could be a request for the extradition of Israeli soldiers who were involved in the killing and in the order to shoot. So this would be hugely significant because obviously Israel, number one, is not cooperating with the investigation. And number two, obviously would never, ever extradite an Israeli citizen to stand trial in the United States for a crime. But if it gets to that point, it's going to be a huge, huge diplomatic incident. And I think it's going to turn even more Americans against further U.S. support for Israel. So it's extremely significant. And the, you know, really overwrought reaction that you saw from Israeli politicians, I think, attests to the fact that they consider this very serious as well.
And finally, you know, this new Israel's new government, you know, the most right-wing government in the history of the country, as many say, and their relationship with the Biden administration, which you made reference to earlier. You know, a lot of parallels, as you say, with the Obama administration, obviously Biden being the vice president at the time, Netanyahu back from the dead, seemingly, in Israel. You know, you literally wrote the book on Obama's failures when it came to, you know, pushing peace in the region. What should people be paying attention to going forward when they look at the continuing relationship between this administration and the new government in Israel?
Well, to answer that question, Michael, I think we have to step back a bit and look at the history of President Joe Biden on the issue of Israel and Zionism and the Palestinian people. As he's the first to attest to, he has, you know, a half century record of support for Israel. He spoke to a Jewish gathering in Detroit when he was vice president. I believe this was the speech in which he said this, and he talked about how he became a committed Zionist at his parents' kitchen table, where his father talked to him about the horrors of the Holocaust and the need of the Christian world to repent for that genocide by compensating the Jewish people with Israel and with ironclad support for Israel. So, you know, this is the tired trope that Joe Biden has grown up with his entire life. And it's something that he's embraced when he went on his trip to Israel and the occupied Palestinian West Bank earlier this year, or shortly before. I can't remember if it was a few days before or during the trip, where he talked about how you don't have to be Jewish to be a committed Zionist. And that's very true. And so, you know, this is who Joe Biden is. These are the policies that have animated his administration for the first 2 years. So I don't expect that we're going to see any dramatic developments out of the Biden administration over the next 2 years, no matter how egregious the new Israeli government is compared to the previous unity government. So the Biden administration, I think, is going to continue to try to place Israel and Palestine on the back burner and hope that things don't boil over. That has been their MO for the past 2 years, and it probably will continue this way as well. You know, the Biden administration has adopted very strange talking points when it comes to the issue of Israel and the Palestinian people. So they've adopted this new rhetoric that doesn't match the rhetoric of any previous administration, that Israelis and Palestinians deserve equal measures of freedom, dignity, and security. And sometimes they throw in a few other words. This is a very curious formulation, Michael, because there's no real policy implications to that. If they deserve equal rights, okay. I mean, who doesn't agree with that? Of course they deserve equal rights, but how are you going to manifest that? What does that even mean? And especially when you combine this with the Biden administration's stance that we're not even going to try to act and pretend like there is a possibility of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations taking place. And we're not even going to pretend that there's a possibility of establishing a Palestinian state in the foreseeable future, but we're just going to preserve the conditions that might make it possible for there to eventually be negotiations that will take place that will lead to a Palestinian state. So you see like how conditioned and how caveated the Biden administration's policy formulations are. And I think that really bespeaks a real lack of any vision and any motivation and any initiative for doing anything on this. They want to stay away from this issue with a 10-foot pole if they can. I don't know if events will allow them to. It could very well be that this new right-wing, even more fascist Israeli government that's coming into power will do something that will trigger something that can no longer be ignored by the Biden administration, that the day-to-day just kind of conflict management template will no longer work for the Biden administration. But I think they're certainly hoping that that will be the case. But we'll see. We'll see if they're able to continue this day-to-day strategy.
Well, Josh, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael.
You have been listening to Professor Josh Reubner speaking on a Mondo Weiss podcast. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, and on kkrn.org, where you can stream us live every Friday morning at 8:38 a.m. Eastern Time. If you miss a broadcast or want to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to our archive on the Internet. Just type into the browser truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and then click on This Week in Palestine Archive. It is all there. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.